is Wednesday, April 26th. Today is a review period for final exam. Okay, so what is your first question?
The bonds.
Okay, let's go back and pull that. That is chapter 2 information, and if you want a place to look in the course pack. Why don't we try around page 13? Nope, that's not right. A little further back. How about page 9 and 10? That should do it. Page 9 and 10. Okay, so I think probably the best thing to do for understanding of covalent and ionic bonds is to give you some background information first. Just want to go back and hit two topics that are critical for understanding that. One is to be a stable atom, and the other is to be a neutral atom. So let's hit the term stable first. When we're looking for stability, we're looking at the valence shell, and we're typically going to find how many electrons to be stable.
Eight,
good. And the name of that special rule is?
Octet.
Good. And then the other term here, neutral, is an issue of positive and negative charges. So what should we count for that? Electrons and protons. Good. So if we have a neutral atom, we should have equal numbers of protons and electrons. Okay, so the catch is, if you have a stable atom, looks like this one here on the left is stable, then there's really no purpose in forming a chemical bond because you've got that octet rule satisfied. You've got at least 8 electrons in your valence shell. So the atom on the left is not really going to form a bond if it was in that stable state. But this one here on the right only has 4 electrons in its outermost orbital or valence shell. So we're going to see that one form a chemical bond. There's two ways to do it that we talked about. You can either share electrons or transfer them. If you share electrons, what kind of bond will that form?
Covalent.
Covalent, good. And of course, if you transfer, that's going to form ionic bonds. Good. Okay, so the thing to do when you've got an ionic bond is to look for the number of electrons and protons. That will confirm for us that we no longer have atoms that are neutral, but instead we have now formed ions. So you have two options here. You've got either a loss of electrons that forms a cation, or gain of electrons that forms an anion. So if you're losing electrons and you're forming a cation, what charge should that atom carry?
Positive,
good. And of course, gaining an electron like this one here gives you an overall negative charge. That's going to make this one an anion. So oftentimes, when you're looking at chemical bonds, you're not going to see a before picture, but just for confirmation, you'll notice that we do have 2 neutral atoms. There's 3 positives and 3 negatives. On the right, we've got 9 positives and 9 negatives. But there's a stability issue here, so we're going to transfer that one electron over to the neighboring atom. And by transferring, what do we do to the valence shells of both atoms? The one with the 9 becomes stable. How about the other one with the 3?
Is the duet rule still stable?
Yeah, good. Duet rule is right. It's still stable. It's got 2 in that innermost. So, in fact, by transferring, you made a win-win situation here. Both atoms are now stable. So, if you didn't have the before and the after picture to compare, if you were just given this after picture once the transfer took place, how would you confirm you had ions here? Good, so you got 3 positives, 2 negatives, so you must have lost an electron. Is this one your cation or your anion?
Cation.
Cation, good. And then again, count and then check. If you've got 9 positives, how many negatives should you have had?
One.
Should have had 9, and in reality we have, what, 10? Okay, so what does that tell us has happened?
It's gained 1.
It's gained 1, yeah, it's an anion. So if you do the count, and get an uneven number there, that says, hey, we probably transferred an electron.
You okay. said for like the neutral, you look at the protons and electrons.
That's correct, yeah. So this may be what you see come final exam time. You may simply see two atoms sitting side by side, and we'll ask you, you know, what kind of bond is this? Right off the bat, you can say it's not hydrogen, it's not covalent, because there's no sharing going on. And really, by process of elimination, you're going to leave yourself with ions. So ionic bonding is going to be the transfer. Again, double check yourself just to make sure. Count those positives and negative charges, and make sure that you confirm a transfer did take place between the two. Hey, just for fun, can you tell me which one of these is our anion? The right? Okay, it has 9 positives. It should have had 9 negatives, but in total there are 10 electrons here, so you're right. That one did gain an electron. Good. So by default, that makes the one on the left what? Cation. Good. So that's all you need to do is confirm that you've got a transfer. You should have a cation and an anion resulting from that transfer. Let's see. We've got covalent bonds that result from a sharing of electrons. And so the catch to look for here is an overlapping of those valence shells. So in this case, we have electrons orbit each nucleus for about half the time. And if the sharing of those electrons is equal, do we have a polar or a nonpolar covalent molecule? If the sharing is equal.
Nonpolar.
Nonpolar, good. In the case of water, the sharing here is unequal. And how do we represent that? What little symbols? The deltas, good. So in the case of water, we do have one atom that tends to be greedy for the electrons. And because the electrons carry a negative charge, we post a delta negative symbol next to the oxygen atom, and that reminds us that oxygen gets more than its fair share of time with those electrons. The two positives that are hereby the two hydrogen atoms come from the fact that electrons are pulled away. So this unequal sharing is what we call a polar molecule. It results in polarity, and that's really what drives our body's interactions. Okay. So covalent molecules share, it can be done equally or it can be done unequally. Now, there's a third type. Since we're on the topic here, let's talk about hydrogen bonds for just a moment. To have a hydrogen bond, you must have a polar covalent molecule. How do we represent a hydrogen bond? Dashes, yeah, dotted line or dashes, good. And it's always an attraction between some partially negative atom on one molecule and hydrogen, which carries a partial positive charge. So this is a slight positive-negative interaction. It does create a very weak bond. That's why we use a dotted line, but it's strong enough to keep those water molecules linked together. Okay, so this results in the cohesion of water molecules. All right, so look for the dotted lines for hydrogens, look for overlapping orbitals for covalent molecules, and then count your electrons and protons to confirm ionic bonding. How about the single, double, triple covalent bond stuff? You okay with that? Need a review on that?
Kinda.
Okay. Was it nitrogen, triple bonded to nitrogen?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's what it was.
Okay, so if you're simply asked what type of bond is here, you have a triple bond between the two nitrogen atoms. Okay, so that's one way to look at this. Another way to look at this is there's actually two nitrogens here. And if we were to write this in shorthand, we would just condense it down to N with a subscript of 2. So there's two things that we can ask when you see a triple bond between two nitrogens. First, what kind of bond is that? It's a triple covalent bond. And then secondly, there's two little nitrogens there, and that is N2 in shorthand. Another one we commonly use when we're talking about this stuff is oxygen. And a bond with another oxygen. Is this an ionic bond or a covalent bond? Covalent, good. Single, double, or triple?
Double,
good. How do you know?
Two lines.
Two lines, good. And if we were to condense this down to shorthand and write a subscript down there, how many oxygen atoms do we have?
Two.
Just two, good. Let's do another one. Let's say we've got oxygen bonded to oxygen and another
that's
one there.
That's the ones that mess me up.
Okay. Glad I thought of that one then.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, double bonds between the oxygens, right? Okay. And then if we're going to do shorthand, there's one, two, and there's your third oxygen. And so in shorthand, this is O3. It's actually ozone.
So there's not going to be any cases where there's going to be a big number in front of the letter.
I'm not going to do something like that. Yeah, I don't think we have stuff like that on there at all.
Okay.
Any questions on single, double, triple, covalent, ionic, hydrogen?
So that's still just a double bond, even though there's two of them?
Correct. There's a still double bonds, even though there's two of them. That's right. How about more on chemistry? Anything else you want to talk about there?
Isotopes.
Okay. So I think we're in the right neighborhood for isotopes. They are back on page 6. Okay, so first of all, let's define the term isotope. Isotopes are atoms of the same element. They simply differ by having differing numbers of neutrons. So you kind of have to repeat that to yourself when you look at a question that deals with isotopes, because all isotopes will have the same atomic number. The atomic number is also going to equal the number of which subatomic particle? Protons. Yeah, protons. So if you're thinking about it in those terms, you can look at these atoms and confirm they are all part of the same element. In fact, they're all carbon atoms since they do have 6 protons. Okay, so the thing that differs between isotopes of the same element is simply the number of neutrons. We can check the nucleus and see that carbon 12 has 6 protons and 6 neutrons. When the atom gets a little heavier, it's got 7 neutrons. Carbon 14 has 8. So that's the only thing that differs. You know, you can even have differing numbers of electrons, but the real thing that matters here is these are all atoms of the same element, same number of protons. It just happens to be the neutron number differs. So let's go and take a look at the periodic table, for instance. We can have a nitrogen atom. And let's say that we've got isotopes of the atoms of nitrogen. So all of those are going to have the same number of what? Protons. Good. And all of them are going to have the number 7 as their proton number. Likewise, all of those isotopes are going to have the same atomic what?
Number.
Good. Now what differs is the number of neutrons, and if you change the neutron number, what also changes?
The mass.
The mass, good.
Because you add the proton and neutron.
That's correct, good. Add the proton, the neutron. So, you know, I know we talked about this way, way back, but when you see the periodic table and something with a decimal point and a number there, you may wonder how we get tenths of a particle, and that's because they average all those isotopes together. So you end up getting the most common ones actually being weighted more when they do that average. Okay, so just keep in mind, isotopes are atoms of the same element, same protons, same atomic number, differing neutrons, differing mass. Okay.
We usually just assume that electrons and protons are the same, correct?
We do, yeah. And unless you're told otherwise, they're going to be the same.
Yep.
Since we're in the chemistry area, how about any other topics there you'd like to talk about?
Depolarization.
Okay, so like nerve impulses and that kind of thing?
Basically, like,
think we're talking chapter 11. It looks like around page 95, 96. That's kind of what you want to hear?
No.
No. Okay. What topic?
Just not right. I gotta find it.
Okay. No problem. While you're looking, anybody else got a question we can go over? Maybe polarity?
That's what I was just going to say.
Was that the topic? I'll let you look. Okay, let's go back to chemistry then. And start on page 14. Intracellular fluid.
Yeah.
In fact, we can do that and mix this all together because that'll be part of our topic. Okay, so let's talk about inorganic compounds just in general. The term inorganic is going to imply to us a certain set of characteristics, including the fact that these molecules are ionically compounded. We're not looking at long chains of carbons and hydrogens. We're looking at things like water and electrolytes, salts, acids, and bases. And we make some inorganic compounds. They just happen to come from a living organism. So we've got water, we've got salts, acids, bases, electrolytes in this category. And you can see for comparison here that these inorganics don't have the long chains of carbons and hydrogens that we do see in an organic molecule, you know, like a carb. Okay, so let's talk about water first. That is a very common inorganic compound in our bodies. In fact, we're around 60 to 70% water. And what makes this a unique molecule is the fact that it is a polar molecule. What does that tell us about the type of bonds holding the atoms together? Equal or unequal sharing?
Unequal.
Unequal sharing, good. And because it's unequal sharing, we represent that unequal sharing with a set of delta symbols. Which atom tends to be the greedy one here?
The hydrogen.
The oxygen, right. And so it carries a delta negative charge. The hydrogens are going to have a delta positive because their electrons are being pulled more toward the oxygen atom. So that polar issue is what drives a lot of the characteristics about water. Water and oil don't mix. Of course, we know that hydrophobic compounds are fats in our body, so they don't mix with water. Okay, and we also know that polarity drives an issue of hydrogen bonding, which is the ability for water molecules to create weak bonds with other water molecules. So how do we represent a hydrogen bond? Yeah, little dotted line, good. Dots or dashes, good. Okay, so in terms of water in our body, water is found in a couple of locations. Intracellular fluid is the majority of our bodily fluids, and that is fluid stored inside of our cells. Around two-thirds or 66% of our fluids are stored inside cells. You know, in total, we tote around between 25 and 30 liters of fluid a day. That's a lot of water. And around two-thirds of that is stored inside of cells. The other one-third of the fluids are stored in the extracellular compartment, and that includes all the spaces outside our cells, such as blood plasma. That's around 2.5 liters. There's interstitial fluid outside our cells, but between our cells and tissues. There's even stuff like lymph, the fluids in your eye, the fluids in your cerebrospinal fluid. So there's a lot of those extracellular compartments. But nonetheless, these are great for cushioning, for maintaining homeostasis. And we know that this is good because water does help to resist temperature changes. So it helps to maintain our body temperature. Okay. So water is our first major inorganic compound. Let's talk about the electrolytes and salts coming from page 15. Before we head there, do you have any questions on anything about water? Okay, and so the term electrolyte implies that it can conduct electricity. These, in fact, do break apart into their cation and anion components when dissolved in water. So in this category, we have things like acids, bases, and salts. Salts are neither acidic nor basic. So common ones, this is kind of fun to go back and do this now. We've talked about these for the most part throughout this course, especially sodium. We've talked about calcium. We've talked about potassium. Really haven't done much discussion on magnesium, but you know, it's kind of fun to go back and say, hey, we're going to talk about these, and we actually did do most of these throughout this course. Chlorine is one that we'll talk a little bit about in Bio 211, especially with hydrochloric acid in the stomach, and we'll talk a great deal about bicarbonate in Bio 211. So, you know, a lot of these are important electrolytes that form acids, bases, and salts. Okay, so in terms of acids and bases, acids and bases are a specific category of our electrolytes. The acids particularly release a certain type of ion when dissolved in water. Do they release hydrogens or hydroxyls?
Hydrogens,
good. Where do you typically find an acid on the pH scale? Below 7, good. Give me a number for a strong acid. Like 0, good. How about a weak acid?
6.
6, good. How about a neutral chemical?
7.
7, right at 7. Where do you find bases on the pH scale?
8 to 14.
Good. Above 7, heading to 14. A very strong base would have a number like?
14.
Good. So a chemical with a pH of 8 releases how many more ions, hydroxyls, than a pH of 6? 8 compared to 6.
8 to 6.
Yeah. 8 releases how many more hydroxyls than a pH of 6? 100.
100.
Yep, 100. Good. Let's compare a pH of 5 to 6. 5 releases how many more hydrogens than 6?
10.
10. Good. And of course, if you get bigger, then we have to do a little more math. So how about 5 compared to 8? I heard one of you say 1,000. Yeah, 1,000. Good. So 10 to the third or 1,000 times difference. Okay. So acids release what types of ions?
Hydrogen.
Good. And bases release what ions?
Hydroxyls.
Hydroxyls. Good. How is a salt different from an acid or a base? Good. They don't release hydrogens or hydroxyls. Good. They'll still have your typical cations and anions like sodiums and chlorines, but yeah, you're right. They're not going to have those hydrogens and hydroxyls to release. Are most electrolytes ionically bonded or covalently bonded? They break apart into cations and anions. Does that help? Ionically, yeah. So if they break apart into cations and anions, they must be ionically bonded. Okay. By contrast, how are most organic molecules held together? Covalent. Yeah, good. Covalently bonded. Good. Okay. How you doing with this? Water, electrolytes? Got any questions on these so far? Okay. That kind of takes you through the inorganic compounds. What topic would you like to cover next? It is so much stuff. It's amazing to look back and think how far we've covered.
So neutralization reactions are just between an acid and a base.
That's correct.
And that's salt and water become a result, correct?
That's right. Good. Could you spot one if given one on the test?
There's an example right here, but I don't know that I could just know it.
let's look at that, because that may in fact be a final question. I think we've got more acid-base stuff than salt stuff on there. I'd expect something on acid-base pH scale, looking at the difference between like 5 and 7 or something of that sort. Less likely to see something on salt.
Okay.
So if these weren't labeled, how would you say, okay, this is neutralization and not like hydrolysis or dehydration synthesis?
I know that it's because of water and of salt come after. But I would have known it if we didn't just talk about it.
Okay, so if you're looking at the reactants, if I covered up and removed base up there, how would you know NaOH was a base?
No.
The OH, good. And likewise, if HCl was not labeled as an acid, what clue can you use instead? The hydrogens, good. So use the OH to clue you in that you've got a base. The H in front typically says, I'm an acid. And then you're right, look for a salt and a water as the products. So of course, water is easy to catch. The salt's not always gonna be NaCl, which is, you know, table salt. The salt is simply gonna be something that's neither acidic nor basic, meaning it doesn't contain what? Hydrogens or hydroxyls, yeah, okay. So you'll use the trick of looking for the OH for the base and the H for the acid. While we're here, let's look at, let's say, hydrolysis and dehydration synthesis reactions. Let me give you a real example. Why don't we look at something from organic compounds to deal with that? Okay, so if you had a reaction like the one at the bottom where you're taking two molecules and adding them together, would you consider that a building reaction or a breakdown reaction?
Breakdown. We're all wrong.
Half of you got it, it's building. Okay, so how do you know that's a building reaction? Sucrose is what type of sugar? Said it is a polymer, yeah. It's disaccharide to be specific. And fructose and glucose are actually monosaccharides. Okay, so that's one clue you can look for. The other clue is the location of water. Since it's sitting there as a product, that reminds us it was dehydrated and removed from the two reactants on the left-hand side, and so they show up down there on the product side. So
dehydration synthesis is building up?
Building up. And dehydration, of course, means water removal, and it's odd, but it shows up here on the product side because it was removed from the reactant side. How could we rewrite that to be a breakdown reaction, this one here?
Put water on the other side? Just flip it?
Flip it, yeah. So put sucrose plus water yields glucose plus fructose. Okay, and so in that case, water would be a reactant. Water would break apart the sucrose molecule into the building blocks. Do you need any more help with dehydration synthesis or hydrolysis?
Can we do one more example?
Sure. This one's similar. So at the top of the screen there, what do you have? That's dehydration. Good. How do you know?
It puts out water and sugar. Does it have to be a sugar?
It doesn't. You could have a protein. You could have anything over there with that water. But the thing to look for is you're taking building blocks like glucose and you're joining them to make a more complex molecule. And it's not an acid base. That's another thing to not get confused with. How about other questions with dehydration synthesis and hydrolysis?
Do we have to have this inorganic or...
I would just know the definitions. Basically, one produces energy, exer, and then, of course, one is going to use energy, and that's an endergonic reaction. So building, in fact, is an endergonic reaction because it takes energy to build things, and exergonic reactions release energy like catabolic reactions. So breaking down is energy releasing. Kind of like digestion works in terms of breaking down food molecules to release energy. In this class, we use them interchangeably with dehydration, synthesis, and hydrolysis.
Okay.
So an anabolic reaction is a building, like dehydration, and breakdown reactions are hydrolysis or catabolic. And in terms of chemistry, they call it decomposition. So in this class, we use those terms interchangeably. Do you need more than that, like some more details?
No, I just couldn't remember which was which, like dehydration, which one did it actually
link up?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, that I keep in mind that synthesize or synthesis means to make, and anabolic steroids bulk up a person, and so I use those clues to remind me that those two are the building reactions. What's your next topic?
There was a question when I took the online quizzes a while back about denaturization.
With proteins? Let's see. Let me pull that up.
It's on the page.
Okay. So in terms of denaturation, we kind of have to think about protein structure. Proteins travel through a primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary level structure. And so some of them are really complex in their shape. That shape is driven by the function. So if you have an environment that's hostile to proteins, something perhaps that's an acidic environment, or perhaps a fever that can denature those proteins, we can literally change the shape and render that protein useless, so it no longer can serve its particular function. So even though this shape here in tertiary and quaternary levels doesn't look like a whole lot to us, it's a lock and key fit with whatever that protein has to do. We talked about enzymes way back, okay? So the place for the enzyme, which is a protein that comes together with its substrate, that special place is called what? Active site, yeah. So if you denature a protein through heat or through acid, then you may make that protein dysfunctional. So, you know, we are always concerned when people have a really high fever, especially for day after day after day, because a high fever can actually denature your proteins in your body. So it can render them...
Could it be, because what messed up is that it was like a temperature that was lower than normal. That ended up being the answer on that one.
Below 98.6 or 37, yes. So hypothermia or cold temperatures are not going to denature proteins. But above 37 Celsius or 98.6 Fahrenheit, we start running into issues with denaturation. Okay, what's your next question? There's no essays. It's all multiple choice. Mm-hmm. We have to grade them and get them in the system so quickly. That's why it's all set up that way.
Is there a lot of pictures?
There's a number of them. I mean, it's...
Like, is this going to be on there?
I can't honestly remember. That may be on there. Plasma membrane structure, structure of muscles, a picture of a bone or two, a muscle or two to identify.
How many questions do you have?
There's 125. Okay, how about your next topic? Membrane transport, sure. Okay, so we're talking about a little bit of membrane transport. Okay, 41. You want to talk about the difference between them?
Yes.
Okay.
The facilitated and solid.
Okay. Okay, so the term diffusion implies that we're moving with a concentration gradient. But when you see the word facilitated, that means that we need some assistance in moving from high to low concentration. Facilitated diffusion is active or passive? Does it require ATP or no ATP?
No.
None needed. Okay, and so we're moving from high to low concentration. No ATP is needed. But the issue is we're moving larger items across the membrane, things like glucose, for instance. So because these items could rip a hole in the plasma membrane structure, we insert these protein channels that help to facilitate the movement of those items across the plasma membrane. So that's the thing to remember, is we're going from high to low concentration. This is passive transport, no ATP required. And we're using protein channels to move these larger items. Okay, so hold that thought, and then let's talk about solute pumping, a form of active transport. Simply, the word active implies that we use what?
ATP,
good. And in this case, we are not going with the concentration gradient from high to low. In fact, what are we doing?
Low to high.
Low to high, right. And since we're moving against the gradient, we have to use a protein pump, not a channel, and we're going to work against the concentration gradient. So in this image, you'll notice that every time we open up this sodium potassium pump, we pay off with this ATP molecule. So I would think of facilitated diffusion and active transport kind of as opposite processes. One's passive, solute pumping is active, facilitated diffusion is high to low, solute pumping is low to high, and of course, ATP is not required for facilitated diffusion, where it is required to pump solutes across the membrane. Okay, size isn't an issue here, it's the concentration gradient that's the issue.
Somebody can hear, you know, instead of read.
Yeah, just to get it seated in your head.
The ones that heal quickly and slowly.
Oh, sure. He'll quick and he'll slow.
Page 50.
Okay. So if you're thinking about epithelial tissues in general, they heal quickly because they are quickly they quickly reproduce by mitosis. So epithelial tissues is one. Loose connective tissues have a good blood supply, and so they heal quickly. Bone, of course, heals quickly, and so does blood. Smooth muscle heals quickly. Okay, so then the ones that are slow healers are things like dense connective tissues that have a difficult time getting blood. Cartilages are avascular, they don't get a good blood supply, so they heal slowly. Skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and nervous tissue all heal slowly.
Yeah.
It feels overwhelming when you flip through the course pack. That's why I recommend the old test, because it's like, okay, I got four tests done, you know.
We should all get 10 extra points for sure.
Golly,
so
man.
A lot of the questions, are all of the questions coming from basically the old test?
I wouldn't memorize them as being absolutely the identical question or the answer choices. So the concepts are the same.
Okay.
So when you take the old questions, think to yourself, you know, how could this be reworded in a slightly different way? And that'll give you double the set of questions you're thinking about when you're taking those old tests. That's why I recommend not just doing your semester, pull the ones off D2L and do those. That gives you at least 2 to 3 semesters worth of old tests to look at. Yeah, don't marry the questions, just date them lightly. You know, just look at the concept. You'll notice there's a trend, the same concepts over and over. Don't forget to look over eye and ear just a little bit. They're mixed in with everything else. And there's also that quiz on the eye and the ear that will close Monday at 11. I'll send out a reminder over the weekend to make sure and take that one. If you're comfortable with eye and ear, you could go ahead and knock that quiz out sometime this week.
Appositional growth.
Okay.
Just in older people, I forget which one's like older people and which one's...
Appositional's older people. Appositional's everybody.
Right.
But only young people have endochondral ossification.
Okay. That's where they lengthen, right?
Lengthen is endochondral, right.
And then, like, diameter is appositional.
Yeah. I think of it like a tree. Trees grow taller only for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they can grow wider at any point in their lifetime. About some other topics.
Sensory motor.
Okay, so in terms of spinal cord, okay, so
let's see the whole picture.
that picture again.
Yeah.
So back into the spinal cord, this is chapters 12 and 13. Just looking at the spinal cord cross-section here, the roots of your spinal nerve branch and come and go from your spinal cord. So one particular portion is responsible for bringing sensory information in, and of course that is which root?
Dorsal,
good. And the ventral root carries what information?
Motor,
good. So it carries information out or away from your spinal cord. When we get into the gray matter of the spinal cord, if you're communicating between sensory and motor neurons, you're using a what?
Inner
neuron, good. And where is that located?
In the dorsal horn.
Dorsal horn, good. So that's, of course, back here at the backside. And we use that dorsal root ganglion kind of as a landmark for the backside of the spinal cord. There are also two horns here that have to do with your motor output. And motor control for skeletal muscles originates in which horn? Ventral, good. And ventral horn controls voluntary movements, while the lateral horn controls what?
Involuntary,
good. So what kinds of movements are controlled there? Smooth muscle?
Cardiac.
Glands. Good, so of course involuntary is the lateral horn, voluntary is the ventral horn. Okay. That's kind of what you want to repeat on that picture. Okay. Anything else while we're in this topic?
the CNS was like the dorsal root, the dorsal horn, lateral horn, and ventral horn.
Actually, it's just the spinal cord, this right here, and then these roots and the spinal
that
nerve.
That is the CNS.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, how about the next topic?
Can we go over depolarization and repolarization?
Sure. Would nerves work, or do you want muscles, or?
Nerves.
Okay, so let's take you to chapter 11, page 95. 96 is a good place to look. Okay, let me start you with page 95 just to kind of lay the foundation here. Nerves that are at rest or muscles that are at rest must be polarized. What does that mean?
Unequal distribution.
Good. Unequal distribution of charges. So inside of our cell, whether it's a muscle or a nerve, we have mostly what ions? Potassium, good. And outside we have mostly
sodium,
good. It is the unequal distribution of charges here that leads to a positive exterior and a negative 70 millivolt interior. Okay, so as long as our sodium potassium pump picks up any stragglers and returns them to their proper locations, we stay around negative 70. Okay, along comes some type of stimulus, and a stimulus can open up our sodium channels. This could be something like an acetylcholine molecule. It could be a thump or a bump against that muscle or nerve. And if we open up sodiums, and enough sodiums come rushing into our cell, we can lead to a state of depolarization. So depolarization means that we're drifting from negative 70, sodiums are coming in, negative 65, negative 60. What special event happens when we hit negative 55? Action potential is guaranteed to happen. Good. That value, negative 55, is known as
threshold.
Good. So threshold allows for us to guarantee an action potential. Action potentials are nerve impulses. And the excitement now is so great that we start opening up sodium channels all down the length of our neuron. So the nerve impulse spreads like wildfire down the length to the next cell. Slow on the uptake are these potassium channels, but eventually they will open. Why is it critical for them to open after we've had the depolarization event kick off? Get back and relax, exactly. So if you let those potassium channels open and close those sodium channels, then we start to restore the negative 70 resting charge on the inside of our cell. This is not gonna fix the problem because now we're gonna end up with sodiums inside and potassiums outside. So how do you get those two ions back to their normal locations?
Is that repolarization?
That is repolarization, good. And of course that involves the pump. Okay, so sodium potassium pump must restore the resting state by pumping back three sodiums to the exterior. How many potassiums come back into the interior?
Two.
Good. Why not just move an equal amount? 3 for 3 or 2 for 2? So what is polarization again? Unequal distribution. So if you pump out 3 and you pump in 2, that's how you create an unequal distribution. So if you get more of them going to the outside and only two for three going inside, that's how you set up a polarized neuron. So that's the goal, is to eventually get you back to that state where you've got a negative 70 resting charge. Okay, so let's talk about ions. During depolarization, where are the majority of your sodiums?
During what?
During depolarization.
On the outside. So the sodium is on the inside, the potassium on the outside.
Yep, depolarization, the sodiums are coming in, good. During repolarization, where are the majority of your potassiums?
On the outside.
Going to the outside, exactly. During resting potential, where's the majority of your sodiums?
On the outside.
On the outside. And during resting potential, where's the majority of your potassiums?
On the inside.
On the inside, good. If we have a negative 70 resting charge, are we depolarized, resting, or repolarized? Resting, yeah. If we're, say, negative 30 going to negative 20, heading to a positive number, what's happening?
Depolarization.
And we're conducting an
action
potential. Exactly, good. If you're right at negative 55, you've hit a critical value called?
Threshold.
Good.
And hyperpolarization.
Hyperpolarization. What happens during that?
That's when the inside becomes negative, more negative.
Good. And what's leaking out?
Potassiums,
good. So potassiums are leaking out.
More sodium.
The sodiums may be coming to a resting state, but the potassiums leaving is the real issue.
So this question said, my value here presents a hyperpora, so, and it was negative 110. So we just go with the most negative option?
Yes. Since if you're going towards 70, 60, 55 and down, towards zero, you're getting closer to action potential. But if you go the opposite direction, yeah, you're going into hyperpolarization territory.
Yeah.
Kind of like a number line. Yeah.
Yeah, can we go over the IPSP and EPSP?
Sure.
I thought I knew it, but like the way you worded on the test, obviously didn't know.
Let's see. Why don't we use the same pictures we were talking about? Okay. So if you excite a cell and you tell it to open up sodium channels and sodium rushes in, you're changing the internal environment to a positive charge and you're more likely to conduct an action potential. This is an EPSP. It's exciting the cell. Sodium's rushing in. So, like for instance, if you want to pick up your hand and scratch your head, telling your arm to move, that is an exciting EPSP that goes to those arm muscles to move your hand. Okay? So, if you want, however, to make your muscles stay at rest and not move at all, then the message sent to those muscles is an IPSP. In fact, the IPSP will often open up potassium channels. How is that going to help you stay at rest?
It's not IPSP?
Yeah, if you open up potassium channels, how does that help you stay at rest?
That was hyperpolarization.
That's exactly right. Yep. So EPSPs lead to depolarization. IPSPs lead to hyperpolarization. So the message for the cell is stay at rest. You're very negatively charged, and potassium leaks out to ensure that there's no chance for an action potential. So the thing I would probably keep straight is depolarization, EPSP, sodium's coming in. Hyperpolarization links up with IPSPs and potassium leaking out. Okay, does that make sense?
So the depolarization is sodium in, and the
hyperpolarization is potassium count. Correct.
Yep.
You got a good trick for it?
Yeah, I ain't saying
it. not we're sharing the recording, but if you got a good one, that's good. Okay, how about your next question?
We're just trying to hold you up, just maybe you'll just start talking.
The next feature on one of our advanced exams, the colorgenic, is similar
yes.
to this, yep. right? How can we tell, because that was one of the ones that I missed on our advanced exam.
How can we tell cholinergic from that picture? That one.
Okay, so acetylcholine binds cholinergic receptors. And so if you see ACH, of course, that stands for acetylcholine. So this is my clue. I've got ACH listed there. If that had said epinephrine or epi or NE, which stands for norepinephrine, you'd say, oh, okay, that's not a cholinergic receptor. That, in fact, is an adrenergic receptor. So adrenergic receptors bind epinephrine and norepinephrine. Cholinergic receptors bind acetylcholine.
Which will give us a little hint.
There has to be a hint there, yeah, like acetylcholine or one of those neurotransmitters.
Okay.